It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, tomorrow is the birthday of Earth Day founder Gaylord Nelson, former governor and senator from Wisconsin. We'll look back at his career and his legacy.
But first, a state elections official warns that candidates could have direct control over millions of dollars of undisclosed corporate contributions following one judge's ruling in the John Doe investigation of Governor Walker's recall election campaign.
Kevin Kennedy, the head of the Nonpartisan Government Accountability Board, raised concerns about Judge Gregory Peterson's interpretation of campaign finance law in an affidavit he wrote back in February.
In addition to having financial control over donations, he also warned that political candidates could form secret committees and direct them to run large-scale and negative advertising without disclosing who made the contributions.
We have Jay Heck with us now. He's executive director of Common Cause here in Wisconsin. Jay, welcome back to the show.
It's great to be with you, Rob. Appreciate it.
It seems like the core issue that Kevin Kennedy was apparently bringing up was this idea of coordination between, if I'm a candidate, my campaign and outside groups. This was like, it seems like there used to be an electric fence between those two organizations in the past. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, this revelation of this snippet from a February affidavit is a really good summary of what this investigation, this now 2 years old almost, is all about. And it really is. For a long time in Wisconsin, it has been illegal for candidate campaigns, candidate of, in this case, Governor Walker in 2012 in the recall election, to coordinate or really even be in touch at all with outside groups that may support that campaign, but using their own resources and, you know, running ads that are not part of the Walker campaign in this case, but ads that would be what we call phony issue ads that would be supportive of Walker or detrimental to Walker's opponent, who was Tom Barrett at the time. So, And what Kevin is saying here, and Kevin, by the way, has been overseeing our elections since 1978, so he knows what he's talking about. What he's saying is that under the interpretation, in this case of Judge Peterson, but also by the charges that have been brought by the Wisconsin Club for Growth and others against this investigation, is that if we don't have this firewall, as you called it, and that's actually a good word for it, then anything could go. There could be the candidate could consult with these outside groups. They could spend millions of dollars. The candidate could direct those ads, but appear to stand away from it, and the public would not have any idea what's going on. And that's very dangerous.
So why is that dangerous? I mean, we know that this campaign and their supporter, they're all on the same side. They're working for the same goal, the election of candidate Walker in that case, or whatever candidate we want to name in the future. Why is it bad if they, you know, divvy up the labor a little bit?
Well, here's the problem, and it's and by the way, if this stands, if this policy that allows coordination stands, it would really go further than even the Roberts Court, the U.S. Supreme Court, has gone, and their incredible opening up of the campaign finance laws in the country and consequently in the state. The problem is corruption. And the deal is that if you have a candidate who's running his own campaign and these outside groups come in, well, the outside groups could be promising all kinds of stuff if, you know, the candidate decides he wants to do something or will do something to favor them. But even more so, the candidate then becomes very beholden to these outside groups for spending, you know, in this case, $9 million. And, you know, it doesn't take a genius to see that the corruption of all of this money could have a very, very deleterious and detrimental effect on the making of public policy in Wisconsin and anywhere else that this is allowed to happen. So this firewall has been in place so that there is no danger, there shouldn't be that danger of that corrupting influence of these outside groups working with a candidate. In 1997, a Supreme Court justice in Wisconsin, who won, by the way, Justice John Wilcox, was fined $60,000 when his campaign engaged in illegal coordination with an outside group. Justice Wilcox didn't even know about it, but nevertheless, that was against the law then. It is now, and it should be in the future.
Well, you mentioned the Roberts Court. They're taking a narrow view of what corruption is. The view would be if my business hands you a bag of money for your personal use, you, the candidate, or builds you a new summer home in exchange for doing something, that's corruption. If I spend on behalf of your campaign or donate to spend on behalf of your campaign, That's political speech. Yeah, it might look a little shady. Political speech is important. The government shouldn't restrict that.
Well, one of the things that that Eric O'Keefe and the Wisconsin Club for Growth are asserting, and some of these other outside groups, is that unless you run a communication that says vote for, vote against, support, defeat, those are what we call the magic words. If you run a communication like that, then yes, you should have to report your donors, and yes, that could constitute illegal coordination. But most groups don't run those types of communications anyway. Most of them run what we call phony issue ads, which is issue advocacy masquerading as campaign ads masquerading as issue advocacy. Those would be the type of ads that say, John Smith wants to pollute your water and destroy your schools. Call John and tell him not to do that. Well, that has the same effect as vote for or defeat. So that's what we call a loophole. And that's the loophole that these groups are trying to exploit. And they're trying to say that by using this, there's no corrupting influence. And again, the U.S. Supreme Court has gone pretty far, but they haven't gone that far. And indeed, the Roberts Court has even said that we should require in Wisconsin and the nation should require disclosure of these outside groups. So at the very least, the people of this country and of Wisconsin would know who's trying to influence their vote at election time. What this whole investigation seeks to do with the Club for Growth is to destroy disclosure and to destroy any laws governing coordination and corruption. We would have literally the Wild West here in Wisconsin, where anything goes and all the money could be spent and no Wisconsinite would know where it comes from or who's giving it to the candidates.
This is just a judge's ruling. Does it really have that much effect, or is this something that could be appealed on and on? Is this almost sidebar in this judge's ruling really going to have that far-reaching an effect?
Well, you know, Rob, there have been so many twists and turns in this entire drama. Just last week, as you may know, Eric O'Keefe and the Wisconsin Club for Growth sued to try to keep the Government Accountability Board out of this. They said that they've overstepped their jurisdiction. There have been, as you say, preliminary decisions made by Judge Rudolph Randa, a very conservative judge in Milwaukee. No, these were all are on appeal. The Randa decision is on appeal before the Seventh Circuit in Chicago. I'm pretty hopeful that that will be overturned. And with regard to whether or not the Government Accountability Board has the right to oversee our elections and to make rulings like this, of course they do. The GAB was set up in 2007, right after the biggest political scandal in Wisconsin's history, the Legislative Caucus scandal, when the State Elections and Ethics Board failed miserably to police wrongdoing in the Capitol, and that five top legislative leaders of both political parties were criminally charged and ousted for office. A bipartisan majority in the legislature set up the GAB in 2007, and they're doing exactly what they're supposed to be doing, which is to investigate things like illegal coordination. So what we're seeing on the part of Club for Growth is an attempt to destroy and go after anybody who is trying to investigate them. I think in the long run, it's going to fail.
You know, with all the Supreme Court rulings lately, limits on aggregate donations by one person to a number of candidates, it seems like the floodgates are open for money. It's going to make it through one way or another. Why is this one issue, this coordination issue and the extensions you've talked about from it, so important?
Well, because coordination does what the Supreme Court and even the Roberts Court has upheld continually is that you can regulate this type of activity if it leads to corruption or, just as importantly, the appearance of corruption. And I don't think it takes a genius to see that if you had these outside groups coordinating with the candidate, there would be plenty of room not only for corruption, but certainly the public would perceive it as total corruption of the system. So that's why I think that the coordination rules are going to stand. I also think that this idea that only those types of communications that use the explicit vote for, vote against so-called magic words, I don't think that's going to fare well in the long run either, because obviously everybody knows that there are many other types of communications that can call for the defeat or the election of a candidate that don't use those words. So I think on both those important counts, justice, in my view, will prevail, that we will have or we will continue to have disclosure. We'll get disclosure, hopefully, in Wisconsin, and that these rules governing coordination between outside groups and candidates will stand. On the other hand, I've been wrong before, and it's very possible that the court could surprise us yet again.
Jay, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Rob. Appreciate it.
That's Jay Heck. He's the executive director of Common Cause in Wisconsin, bringing us up to date on what he sees as possible fallout from just one of the twists and turns of the John Doe investigation. On Earth Day 1970, 20 million Americans displayed their commitment to a clean environment. It was called the largest demonstration in human history at the time. More than a billion people now participate in annual Earth Day activities. The idea of this day set aside to focus on protecting the natural environment was the brainchild of U.S. Senator Gaylord Nelson of Wisconsin. Tomorrow is the birthday of Gaylord Nelson, and today we check in with someone who can tell us about one of Wisconsin's most well-known political figures.
Bill Christofferson is a former journalist and longtime Wisconsin political consultant, now retired. He lives in Milwaukee. He's the author of the book, The Man from Clear Lake, Earth Day founder Senator Gaylord Nelson. Bill, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me. I'm always happy to talk about Gaylord.
Well, let's talk about some of his politics. You know, on the eve of his birthday, tomorrow is his birthday. Tell us a little bit about where these politics came from.
Well, he grew up in a political household in Clear Lake, Wisconsin, in Polk County, up near the Minnesota border. His parents, his dad was a country doctor, and his mother was a nurse. And they were both progressive followers of Fighting Bob La Follette, the famous reformer, and were deeply involved in progressive politics. And so he grew up surrounded by that, and clearly was shaped by that and became a leading progressive himself.
And he was elected governor age 42 in 1958. What was his platform for Wisconsin at the time?
Well, it was interesting. He was only the second Democratic governor in Wisconsin in the 20th century. And the first one was kind of an accident. It was during the Roosevelt landslide in the 1930s. So the odds were pretty long against him, and he really didn't expect that he would win. He thought he would run and get known and get his name established and probably run again a second time. But he ran on a platform. He described the Republicans, who had been in control of everything for 20 years, as fat and feeble. It said they had a lot of dead wood. They've been sweeping problems under the rug. The leadership is old and tired. They've got fat and flabby being on the job for 20 years. That kind of thing. Basically, that it was time for a change. That Wisconsin had been a one-party state for too long, and it was really time for a change and to give the Democrats a chance. And the Democrats in Wisconsin had been almost non-existent for a long time. Gaylord and a handful of other people in the late 1940s and 1950s built the party almost from scratch to where it became competitive. And the first breakthrough was in 1957 when Bill Proxmire won a U.S. Senate seat. And then the following year, Gaylord was elected governor, and Wisconsin, for the first time in decades, truly became a competitive two-party state.
Well, he was only governor for 4 years, and then he moved on to the U.S. Senate, ran there. What made him decide to run after only 4 years?
Well, these days we say only 4 years, especially, I guess, after Tommy Thompson and some others. But in those days, the governor's term was a two-year term, so he had already been elected twice. And his feeling at the time, and it's hard to imagine that now, but that was that he had accomplished most of his agenda in that four-year period, and he had gotten a lot done and wanted to take the opportunity to make a run for the Senate. Again, it was a real underdog campaign against Alexander Wiley, who was the senior Republican in the Senate at the time. His conservation record as governor, one of the main accomplishments of his time as governor was was to create a really visionary conservation program that these days we know as the Stewardship Fund. At the time, it was called the Outdoor Recreation Action Program. But it set aside a penny a package tax on cigarettes to raise $50 million to preserve open space and recreational land and wildlife habitat. At the time that no one in the country was doing that, it became kind of a model for other states, and it stamped him as indelibly, gave him a national reputation too as an environmentalist, or at the time we called him conservationists, and that had a lot to do with his successful run for the Senate too, that people really related to that.
Well, as you say, he was kind of ahead of the curve on conservation and later on environmentalism. Where did that come from?
Well, when you ask him about it, he would say that he became an environmentalist by osmosis growing up in Clear Lake. And he describes his boyhood in Clear Lake, which at the time was a village of about 700 people, really is idyllic. He and his friends spent almost all of their time outdoors. Spent a lot of time either hunting or fishing or in the summertime swimming and camping and hiking, and he was all of them. He and his friends were outdoor kids and very interested in nature, and I think his mother had a big influence too. She also was an environmentalist, but he couldn't. When you would ask him, he would say he could never remember a time really that wasn't an issue that he cared about.
And in terms of his contributions to the field of conservation and environmentalism, he is probably best known for being the founder of Earth Day. Where did he come up with that idea?
Well, he had the idea from the time he was elected to the U.S. Senate, even before he took office. His one main agenda item was to try to find a way to get the environment onto the national political agenda and make it part of the debate. And his first idea was to enlist the president, John Kennedy, and he persuaded JFK to do a national tour and talk about conservation issues. And Gaylord thought, if the president says this is important, that's it. It's going to catch on, and everybody's going to pay attention. Well, that didn't turn out to be true, and he was disappointed by that. So he went back to the Senate, and this was in 1963. 6 years later, he was in California making a series of speeches about environmental issues. Had just been in Santa Barbara, where he had seen the site of a huge oil spill in the ocean, and was on the plane to his next stop in Berkeley reading a magazine about the teach-ins that were going on at the time on college campuses about the war in Vietnam. And he said that the light came on. He said, why don't we have a teach-in about the environment? And that's how he announced, in September of 1969, he announced in a speech in Seattle that there would be a national environmental teach-in the next spring. And it was a story that made the wire services, but not a big story, but it ran around the country. And his office was inundated with calls and contacts from people who wanted to know how they could be involved, to the extent that his Senate office couldn't handle it. They had to set up a nonprofit organization called the Environmental Teach-In, which eventually, by April, became Earth Day. But it was only 7 months later that Earth Day happened, and 20 million people, as you said in the introduction here, at the time it was 10% of the people in the country participated in one way or another. So it was beyond his wildest imagination.
And just very briefly, Bill, not long after that we saw the Clean Air and Clean Water Act. Did he see Earth Day as leading a momentum to get that legislation passed just a couple years later? And I'm sorry, just 30 seconds left or so.
Clearly, Earth Day started what became known as the Environmental Decade. And in the next 10 years, 28 major pieces of environmental legislation were passed, more than had been passed in the entire history of the country before that. And clearly, Earth Day launched all that.
Well, Bill, thank you so much for coming on and talking about Gaylord Nelson with us today.
Well, thank you, and happy birthday tomorrow, Gaylord.
That's right. Gaylord Nelson's birthday would be tomorrow, 1916, the year he was born. We've been talking to Bill Christopherson, the author of The Man from Clear Lake, Earth Day founder, Senator Gaylord Nelson. It's fair to say that there's a period of American history that we as Americans don't always feel comfortable addressing, the period when slavery was the law of the land in this country. And when we do talk about it, we're not always getting it right.
Our next guest says that as a nation, we haven't done enough to educate ourselves about the institution and the reality of slavery. In a new article, she makes the case that we need a national museum dedicated to slavery in America, telling the story, the history, and its long-lasting effects.
Joining us now is Sarah Fanning, assistant professor of history at Texas Women's University. She recently wrote a piece called The United States Needs a Slavery Museum for Pacific Standard. Sarah, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
So we have museums in the country that deal with other difficult parts of American history. Why would you say a museum for slavery has been overlooked?
Well, I think it's because of the emotional and historic guilt, I believe, the United States feels about slavery and our role in this institution. And the issues are so fraught, I believe, that even if I bring this topic up to friends, sometimes they just look at me and they say, well, that's so difficult to talk about. I don't know how you could exhibit something like this in a museum setting. So I think it is just such a difficult topic.
Well, there is the Smithsonian's National Museum about African-American history and culture. Does that sort of get at these issues, or is it not enough?
Well, this museum is slated to open in 2015, and it will look at slavery, and they have exhibits that are planned. I believe they have bought a slave cabin from the South Carolina and that they are bringing up to put in and have as a permanent exhibit. However, that's only one of, you know, many, many other exhibits and shows that they'll be focusing on. And I don't believe that there'll just be enough time, enough space in the actual museum location for slavery to be given the due it deserves in our consciousness and our understanding of American history.
There are other vehicles for teaching American history and educating people about it. And some of these other areas would be, you know, film, and we have the schools. Why do we need a museum specifically?
Well, there actually aren't that many sites to study slavery. Richmond, Virginia has made some efforts to push for a slave museum, and they're having a lot of pushback from the mayor there, I believe, who wants to incorporate it into sort of a large commercial and residential complex and just have it as one of, you know, many buildings that will be established. And the people in Richmond want to, you know, have this historic area that was where the slave trade had existed for 40 years prior to the Civil War. And no, I'm sorry, even longer than that. It started in 1808. And so they want to preserve that history in all of its entirety, looking at the jails, looking at the lawyers' offices, looking at the auction sites. And so that's, you know, that's more than a museum, but they're having a very difficult time in terms of the city council figuring out, you know, which plan is best. But getting back to the question about a museum specifically, there have been exhibits, but none of them have been permanent. And in New York, Historical Society, I think in 2006, did a Slavery in New York exhibit, and then they did a second one called New York Divided, and those were very, very successful, and there's so much interest in this topic, but again, there's not one specific site where people can go, like at a Holocaust museum.
And there's, you know,
there's many of them.
There's also some specific research, isn't there, that people produce more empathy when they see things at a museum?
Yes, yes. And I mean, similar, I think, to how film can, you know, bring emotion out, make you think about, you know, gosh, how would I feel in that situation? Museums can do that and have, you know, an educational component and even a sort of time to reflect as you're there. And so the, you know, museum is a great site to have education, have these discussions, and just bring forth the, you know, the emotions around this topic.
What kinds of holes are there, do you think, in American education about slavery, about the reality of it, that a museum might be able to fill?
Well, first, that recently we've had some, you know, remarks made in the public sphere. There was a congressional candidate, Jim Brown. There's also Walter Block. And then, you know, the most recent is Cliven Bundy. And, you know, there's this perception that, oh, slavery wasn't bad, that, oh, they were well-fed or, and, you know, provided, yes, they had to work, but that's, you know, these are somewhat shocking responses to the history of slavery. There's been, you know, tremendous interest in this at the academic level, you know, at the university level. There's been lots and lots of books written about slavery, and you know, I'm just looking at one now called American Slavery, and it's in its 10th anniversary edition by Peter Colchin. But for some reason, it has not trickled down into, you know, the primary and secondary. There's a lot of interest in the Holocaust. I would say many public schools will devote a week, maybe even a month, to the studies of the Holocaust. But nothing is really ever said about slavery. And I think it's because there is this, you know, unease. It's a very fraught history.
Well, the Holocaust is certainly difficult to talk about, and yet we have museums dedicated to the Holocaust. Is there something maybe particularly American about slavery, maybe therefore more personal, that makes it more difficult to talk about?
Well, I think that it is, in one way, it's easy to talk about the Holocaust because it didn't happen here. and the second issue is that many people, I'm here in Texas. You know, there are students in my classes. I have them do family history projects, and they come to realize that, wow, my goodness, I had an ancestor that was a slave owner. And many of them feel guilt and shame, and some of them don't even really want to share it with the class. And so there's, I mean, it is very personal at times. And, you know, many people say, well, I wasn't even here. I don't have anything to do with that. And they're not interested in that history. So I think there's kind of those different approaches going on in terms of why there isn't this interest in slavery and the history and experiences.
There are people out there who say that we do have places that are adequate toward addressing slavery. We have Thomas Jefferson's Monticello, we have George Washington's Mount Vernon, Andrew Jackson's The Hermitage, and that those places maybe address some of what you're talking about. But would you say that's true? Do these places get at the history and the horror of slavery the way that some people say they do?
Well, I mean, we spend a lot more time talking about our founding fathers' governing practices than we do their experience of being slave masters. And the, you know, these are sites where slavery happened. This is where, you know, the violence occurred. And to say that these are adequate is it's like saying a concentration camp is an adequate space to understand the Holocaust. It's not, and you need a and a objective space in some ways to reduce the horror in some ways, and to allow people to come to the subject and with an open mind.
We're talking right now with historian Sarah Fanning. She says the United States needs a slavery museum in order to properly address the history of slavery in the country, and a national slavery museum would do that.
We'd like to hear what you think. Do you think this is a good idea? Would you like to see this kind of national museum of American slavery? Do you think the country needs to make more of an effort, a good faith effort, to address the history and long-lasting effects of slavery? Do you think there's a lot that you know that we don't know about slavery in our country's history? You can give a call, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can call in now or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Right now we're talking with Sarah Fanning, professor of history at Texas Women's University, and she says we need a national museum dedicated to slavery in America, its reality, its history, and its long-lasting effects.
And you can join in with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. What do you think about this idea? What would you like to see this kind of museum address? How would you like to present these issues? Call in at 800-642-1234 or email talk@wpr.org.
And we're going to go to our phone lines right now and take a call from Bill calling in Greendale. Hi, Bill.
Hi, everybody. I just wanted to, I think it's a great idea. In Milwaukee, there was the Black Holocaust Museum run by James Cameron, who has a remarkable story. I met him in my church, and he was almost lynched. And it was good for me to hear from somebody personally, an African-American, and this was during the 20th century. So just kudos to the guest, and I wondered if she had heard about the Black Holocaust Museum in Milwaukee.
Great. Thank you, Bill. Sarah?
No, I have not heard of that particular museum, but I know that there's one called Least We Forget. It's a Black Holocaust Museum of Slavery that is traveling, and it is based in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. So that's a traveling Holocaust Museum of Slavery. But no, I haven't heard of this. I'll look it up.
Thank you a lot for that call, Bill. And Sarah, earlier you were talking about some recent opinions that were expressed, a couple people publicly stating, you know, maybe slavery wasn't so bad and the slaves were well cared for and it fueled the economic engine of the country, just to kind of toss a few of the comments out there. And another problem you have that you're hoping the National Slavery Museum, should it happen, would address was the holes left by film. You know, film does educate, but film can also, do the opposite. And you have a problem with Gone with the Wind in particular. What kind of damage do you think that movie has done?
Well, that is the most watched film, I believe, in the history of U.S. film, I believe. And, it's very beautiful cinematically, but the story is, there's the, very faithful slave mother, or, mammy, as they're often called, and she's the one in charge. There's no real indication of the work, except of, the domestic servants. And in fact, three-fourths of most enslaved people worked in the fields. Maybe one-fourth worked in homes or plantation houses. And so that film just is not an accurate depiction. Thankfully, now we have 12 Years a Slave, which has come out and is much more accurate in terms of, obviously, the violence and the number of workers that were required to run these plantations and the level of work. I mean, they are building everything in that film. And that is one of the cases of, yes, the foundations of this country were built on the work of slaves, and I think that film depicts that very, very well.
Let's go back to the phone lines now. We've got Karen, who's joining us in Viroqua. Hi, Karen.
Hi. No, I think it's a good idea, but I was just wondering if it would encompass indentured servitude as well as the chattel slavery, as the earlier forms of indentured servitude in this country were very much like slavery, almost the same thing. And then there's more modern forms like wage slavery and prostitution that exist today. And would those be included in a museum like this?
All right. Thank you, Karen. And Sarah, what about broadening the scope to different kinds of slavery?
Yes. Well, there is, I definitely agree that the history of indentured servitude needs to be included in a National Slavery Museum. And I'm not so sure that modern forms of slavery would fit in my vision of what this slavery museum would be. But there is a place in Cincinnati called the National Underground Railroad Freedom Center that actually does address modern slavery, and they are one of the closest museums that we have to what I could see it being a national slavery museum. They are focused on the stories of those who ran away, the Underground Railroad. The reason I say this is not a national slavery museum is because their focus is on, you know, Ohio's role in this Underground Railroad. And that was a mostly 19th century history. And as we know, slavery, if the first slaves arrived in the United States, or what will be the United States, in 1619. So, you know, that's a whole other history that's not included. That is often forgotten about. People think slavery is only in the southern United States. It was not. It was everywhere. There was actually a recent op-ed in the New York Times by a historian who's looking at California and African Americans' experiences before the war. And, you know, many of them actually were sent back to the South. So this, you know, this is one of those holes you're asking about in terms of mm-hmm. our understanding, you know, at the educational level, is that slavery, because of the Civil War, was only a Southern institution. It was not.
Well, thank you so much for your call, Karen. And we're going to go next to Curtis in Milwaukee. Hi, Curtis.
Hi, good afternoon. I'm aware of the National Museum of African American History and Culture that's being built currently in Washington, D.C., and I think we need to let that one take form before we start talking about another museum that might attribute itself or be attributed to slavery. I would also be careful of the indentured servant question, because clearly many of the people who in indenture were not African Americans during the course of some of the history of this country. So I'm one of those that would rely upon the current building of the National Museum in Washington to cover the period of slavery in its fullness, as far as I'm concerned, as opposed to creating a separate museum.
Why do you think that, Curtis? Are you worried that it will distract focus?
I'm involved in an activity that clearly, when it was initiated, it was for the descendants of slaves or slaves of descendants of slaves in America, African American slaves in America. It has now evolved into where it's a major activity relating to white women, all because it's brought under the label of disadvantaged, as opposed to the true history of the people we're talking about.
All right. Well, thank you for the comments, Curtis. And Sarah, what do you think?
Well, in terms of the indentured servitude, I think that's important to understanding the progression of labor in the colonial America. That there were black and white working together in the fields of the Chesapeake, and they were indentured servants. took time for chattel slavery and the laws surrounding that institution to develop. And so, you know, the idea that we've always had slavery, it was not the case. It developed and progressed over time. And in terms of the Smithsonian National Museum, I was very hopeful as well when I was looking at this museum, and I'm waiting for its opening. And but I was surprised when I read its mission statement, and there's not one discussion or point made about slavery. And I think that should be the mission of such a museum.
And we're going to, I'm sorry, I'm just going to jump in so we can get to one more quick call here before the end. Quinn from Randolph, hi.
Hi there. I think it's a really good idea to have a museum, but I also wanted to point out that I am in eighth grade right now, and the fact that we haven't learned as much about slavery as the Holocaust isn't true. We've learned a lot about slavery, and especially in fifth grade, we watched many films and read many books about how slaves were tortured, raped, and many other things, and we did spend a lot of time on it.
Interesting. Quinn, thank you so much for your perspective there, and we're going to have to leave it with Quinn. Sarah, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Sarah Fanning, Assistant Professor of History at Texas Women's University. We've got a link to her piece, The United States Needs a Slavery Museum, on the Central Time Facebook page.